On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, plenty of choices for farmers to revegetate rivers and streams.
When we select these plants to grow in a particular place, we've got the choice between growing something that naturally evolved near the coast or naturally evolved in these cold floodplains or naturally evolved up in the alpine region.
And patience, the key to growing pine nuts in Tasmania.
The cones take 3 years to mature, so it's not a crop like a typical crop where you have an annual takeoff. They start from being a jelly bean sort of size, and then they'll go through to being something the size of a large grapefruit, so weigh possibly just under a kilo.
Yes, we take you to a pine nut farm in North Tasmania later in the program and meet a very patient farmer. As well, the importance of revegetating rivers and streams for farmers. We'll go into detail with that story shortly. G'day, Tony, with you on this Thursday, where we also look at the new national guidelines for dairy farmers when it comes to feeding and housing the cows. Trust the weather has been kind to you today, wherever you are in the state. Looking brilliant where I am, so we'll check in with the Bureau to see what's in store for the next few days. And we'll take your thoughts on any issues via the text line. You might have a favourite pine nut recipe or a use for pine nuts. Let us know. 0438 922 936 is that number. 0438 922 936. First up to the aquaculture industry. And a new climate change report says fisheries yields within Australia face an imminent threat from a warming planet. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's latest report says fisheries yields face a 3 to 10% drop if global average temperatures rise by up to 2 degrees. Australian Institute of Marine Science principal researcher Dr. Mark Meakin says climate impacts on Australian waters could be significant.
Well, the problem is, I guess, that despite some efforts to date, we're well on the way to global surface temperatures reaching above 1.5 degrees Celsius above historic levels. And that doesn't bode well for marine ecosystems around the planet. And particularly, it doesn't bode well for fisheries and for the reason that the most productive fisheries, those in temperate regions. And that's where the majority of the world's protein from fisheries comes from. It comes from these cool water habitats.
The report, I guess, models two scenarios. One that looks at warming of 0.9 to 2 degrees in the planet and how that will affect fishery yields, and then also a higher global temperature rising of 3.4 to 5.2 degrees. So for Australia, the, I guess, lower modelling there shows there could be a 3 to 10% drop in yields. And for that higher modelling, it says that drop could be almost up to 30%. So why, particularly in Australia, is warming of the planet so problematic for fisheries?
Well, a couple of reasons, really. There's just so many effects that the warming on the planet can actually have on fisheries. There's things like changes in habitat. So to our north, where we've got coral reefs, basically warming brings on bleaching. It brings on a destruction of coral reefs. That removes the habitat for fishes. As we move south, then it's fishes that have maybe temperate, you know, more cold water adapted. As the water's warm and that warm water pushes south, those fishes, their range literally falls off the continent. After, you know, Western Australia, after you reach Cape Leeuwin, there's nowhere for those fishes to go. They can't head south to cooler water anymore. And the third thing that happens as well is that as water's warm, fish tend to grow a little bit faster, but they also reach smaller sizes. So fisheries production doesn't go down just in terms of having less habitat and the fish being pushed out of their range, but also the fact that fish that remain tend to be smaller. And then you've got to compound that as well with issues like warmer water holding less oxygen and increasing acidification in warm water. So it's an assault from all sides, basically.
As you mentioned there, it is a very wide-ranging issue and a lot of different things come into it. But is there any species of fish that, I guess, experts are particularly worried about could be, you know, in danger of really dropping, you know, from a fishery sense?
Well, look, you know, there's a whole temperate fauna out there of fish that are, you know, sport fishermen like and are targeted by commercial fisheries. And some of our most popular eating fish, things like snappers, for example, right? Those are really temperate or, you know, warm temperate water fish, cool temperate water fish. Once their habitat warms up so that, you know, they have to move out, they're essentially going to run out of anywhere to go. We just simply don't have a landmass that stretches far enough south to actually hold a habitat for them. But that's a scenario for the future, right? Right now, we're at a crossroads, and that's what the IPCC report basically points out, where it's still not too late. We have all the techniques at our fingertips to actually change the trajectory that we're on. We need the determination to put all of those into play.
As you said, the IPCC report does, you know, provide, I guess, a snapshot and a warning for the world. Again, particularly looking at fisheries, and we mentioned earlier that the lower end of the modelling, 0.9 to 2 degrees of warming, says there will be around a 3 to 10% drop in fisheries yields in Australia. Is that still, I guess, a very significant hit to the fisheries industry in Australia if yields were to drop by that much?
Oh, absolutely it is. Look, you know, we don't actually have hugely productive fisheries in Australia. Our fisheries production is actually quite low. We have a continent that, you know, is a very dry continent, so we don't have a lot of rivers inputting nutrients into the coastal ecosystems. We don't have a lot of upwelling in Australia. That would be cool water upwelled from the bottom that's nutrient rich. Places like, you know, South America and Peru, Africa have those sorts of upwelling systems that really drive fisheries production. New Zealand does too. But in Australia, what we have are systems where there's warm water currents running down both coasts, the East Australian Current and the Leeuwin Current on the West Coast. And those actually keep our fisheries yields quite low. So we don't have big fisheries to start with. And when you're cutting those down, even if it's only by 3 to 10%, that's still a very significant hit.
What's your message, you know, perhaps for the public or for governments who may be making decisions about the future of marine environments in Australia and, you know, the importance of this IPCC report?
Well, look, the IPCC report is unequivocal. It's humans, it's us that are doing this to the planet, and we need to take responsibility for that and really take responsibility for what future generations are going to inherit. The IPCC report puts it in black and white as to what will happen to the planet, our best guess at it anyway, and we ignore that at our peril. It's time to act, and it's time to act now.
That's Dr. Mark Meegan from the Australian Institute of Marine Science speaking there with Sam Bradbrook about the threat to fisheries yield from changes in climate. We're talking weather and climate. If floods are front of mind for anyone right now, it's farmers who are more and more looking to protect their properties long term. Herbert Stobman is a revegetation expert with over 35 years' experience. He says revegetation is integral to stabilising rivers and therefore avoiding costly damage. He also says property resilience is not the only benefit, nor does it come without challenges.
Vegetation on rivers and streams are very, very important for improving the resilience of these streams to the environmental impacts that they're subjected to.
Yeah, and they are definitely becoming more frequent. Can you tell me a bit more about how important the revegetation aspect is to preparing farmers for floods?
Yeah, well, vegetation has got a big role in helping stabilise the streams and stream banks in particular. And farmers are realising that some streams were over-cleared in the past.
And with floods being pretty front of mind for a lot of farmers, do you find that they are considering revegetation more and focusing on it more?
Yeah, more farmers are interested in, and it's not just for stream stability. Often there are multiple reasons why they want to establish native vegetation. Some of it is to improve the aesthetic appearance of their farms or the environment that they are working in. There is obviously the biodiversity benefits that they can see, having a healthier bird life and insect life that provides an ecological balance for their operation. And obviously stock shelter. Often these smaller streams that are revegetated double up as shelter for livestock. and crops, but particularly livestock.
And which species of plants are the best in terms of flood preparation?
Oh, look, there are so many species that are important there. You can't single any out, really. There are certain species that are very important close to the water's edge. You know, there are sedges and rushes that are really important, or woody tea trees. But as you look at the middle bank or the upper bank, there are different species that thrive there then. So it's very site-specific which species are the important ones.
And you did mention in your talk as well the importance of getting genetics right for species. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the same species will grow over a wide range of environments. And over tens of thousands of years, the plant has evolved to or adapted to the environments that they're growing in. So when we select these plants to grow in a particular place, we've got the choice between growing something that naturally evolved near the coast or naturally evolved in these cold floodplains or naturally evolved up in the alpine region. So they've obviously have got different genetic adaptations that allow them to thrive in their environment. So when we go and select plants for certain sites, we think about that and we pick plants that are best suited for that site.
Obviously, the revegetation area needs to work in conjunction with livestock, for example, but that might involve some compromises. How can a farmer manage that? And I guess I'm talking about livestock damaging the soil where they're trying to revegetate and those types of things.
Yeah, look, compromises, yeah, life's full of compromises, isn't it? For farmers, really, the important thing is they need to understand, and most farmers do now, they understand that that livestock and revegetation plantings don't really mix. So it's the importance there is good fencing, at least to give the revegetation project a chance to grow to maturity or close to maturity before livestock even come near them again. So it actually means excising that land and keeping livestock out. And that's just livestock. Then there's wildlife to consider as well, and that's where it gets difficult again. We actually need to manage wildlife populations, particularly macropod populations, to get revegetation to work, because they have also evolved that with native seedlings as a food source. so they'll eat them.
Yeah. And fair enough too, yeah, I guess.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it can take years and years for the plants to mature and become strong enough. So are there any other things that you recommend farmers do to protect them from that impact of wildlife and livestock?
Yeah, look, there are many tools in our toolbox, but it is very site specific or project specific which tools and which combination of tools we use. So it ranges from, you know, total exclusion fencing to using certain tree guards or using browsing repellents, and often in combination with actually managing the population size. As hard as that sounds, that's often necessary.
What's the main thing that you would tell a farmer about revegetation and preparing for floods?
I think the main thing I would like to tell farmers always is to do good planning, to do really, really careful good planning before you start, so that you maximise your success for the time and energy and money you put into it. You want to get maximum outcomes, and that is only possible if you do good planning. And once you've done the planning and you've got an understanding, then stick to that timetable and plan you've developed, and don't take shortcuts.
No shortcuts. Liffey Valley revegetation expert Herbert Storbum talking there to Madeline Rojan about the role of plants in food revegetation. Coming up on the Country Hour, new national guidelines to help dairy farmers with feeding and housing the cows.
This week on Landline, the toll of life on the water.
You're weak if you can't handle it. So, of course, that's the stigma that we're we're slowly changing.
And supporting early childhood learning in the bush.
We do things like messy play that mums are like, ah, no, you know, or we just be, you know, we just be.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
I'll take you on a visit to a special nut farm later in the program, a pine nut farm. I think it's the only one in Tasmania. We'll find out later on. Well, dairy farmers have been provided with new national guidelines to help them set up innovative feeding and housing solutions. Launched at the Dairy SA Conference, Agriculture Victoria and Dairy Australia have come up with a 245-page document aimed at on-farm decision-making and improving profitability. National Feeding and Farm Systems Lead with Dairy Australia, Karen Romano, says that whilst the new guidelines have been developed specifically for Australian conditions, they have been modelled on current global best practice.
So these guidelines are the first of their kind globally. They actually draw insights from international Australian and agriculture Victoria experts, and they provide dairy farmers with the best practice approach while when considering local feeding and housing resources within Australia.
So this is the first ever, I believe?
Now, this is these are the second edition guidelines. The first edition guidelines were written by Scott McDonald and were only Victorian-based, and they only addressed feed pads and free stalls because at that stage we only saw three free stalls in the horizon back in 2010. Now, in 2023, we've actually got 161 different types of contained housing systems underway in Australia. Operating environment has changed, and so we've actually taken the opportunity to expand the guidelines beyond Victoria to a national footprint and also invite global subject matter experts to actually share their experiences, which we can Australianise for our Australian farming conditions.
That was going to be my next question. It was designed and looking at local Australian conditions and regulations, but you did approach a lot of people worldwide looking at global best practice. How did it go about getting that information to put these guidelines together?
Yeah, great question, because as you know, and as I've indicated in my earlier response, that Australia is fairly new into this space. We've seen quite a bit of development within Victoria and now emerging in other states. But the US, United States has been at the forefront in this space for a number of years. And we have specialists, for example, you spoke to Jake Martin earlier, who's an agricultural engineer, has been working this space for over 30 years. And so they're the type of people that we tapped on the shoulder to say, can you actually make a contribution to these guidelines? In addition, another expert from internationally was well-known researcher Nigel Cook from Wisconsin Madison University. He's written considerable papers about the welfare and bedding and the management of contained housing systems. And so his contribution to this document has really strengthened those chapters within the resource.
How many dairy farmers would be looking at contained housing or using it?
Great question. So probably 4 or 5 years ago, as I mentioned, in 2010, we only had three free stalls in Australia. Now, currently, Scott McDonald through Agriculture Victoria has been working with about 161 different operations ranging from dairy dry lot, loose housing, which is a compost bedded packed barn or deep litter barn, and then also with free stalls. So we're seeing an increasing trend and interest in this space. And I actually believe that this will continue given the volatile operating environment some farmers are facing. So we look at the floods that are occurring in New South Wales in the Murray Dairy region and more recently the end of the Murray in South Australia where I am now. These changed operating environments are causing farmers to rethink their farm systems and work out, well, how can I introduce feeding and housing infrastructure to mitigate some of these issues that are affecting the way I farm?
Did you have to change the guidelines at all, Karen, with all these floods that you are seeing and the issues that dairy farmers have been facing?
Not necessarily change the guidelines, but look at how we can put those in the forefront of some of the farmers in those areas to consider. But one of the insights that did come out, particularly in summer regions, was thinking about the location of feed resources on farm, which can be considerable, and having those feeding kitchens and resources are stored above the flood line. So we've had examples of some systems within the Murray Dairy region and also in the New South Wales coast where fodder or forage supplies were lost due to flood waters or other conditions. And so that should be in the forefront of mind. Not only are we trying to build these feed structures and housing infrastructures in a space where they're above the flood line, but also the feed resources associated with those systems as well.
Just finally, Karen, these guidelines, are they relevant to all dairy farmers?
Absolutely. So they actually cover grazing systems which incorporate feeding infrastructures such as basic feed pads, concrete feed pads, or roofed housing facilities such as Australian cow homes. And then they also relate to farmers considering intensifying their farm business, shifting away from grazing to a zero grazing system where cows are fed a TMR ration. And so that's relevant in that space is dairy dry lots, our loose housing facilities and free stalls. So we actually, because they're national, they hold relevance to our entire industry and should be seen as a go-to resource when you're considering making any changes to your farm system with those types of infrastructure in mind.
That's Karen Romano from Dairy Australia speaking there with Brooke Neindorf about the new national guidelines to help innovate feeding and housing solutions with dairy farmers. You can find those guidelines on the Dairy Australia website. As more cases of varroa are identified in New South Wales, one avocado grower near Sydney is deeply concerned about efforts to contain the outbreak. Tim Kemp is on the Central Coast, north of Sydney. He often gets hives on his property to pollinate the trees, but he's been prevented from doing so due to the increasing number of exclusion zones and the restrictions on bee movements. He's told Michael Condon he's getting pretty anxious about the effectiveness of the control effort.
I was feeling fairly comfortable a little while ago that they may have had this under control. But the fact that there's been such a period of time between the last detection and these latest detections is a real concern. And the other thing that really concerns me is the fact that the detections that have been found have been on the extreme south and the extreme north of the zones. And so it suggests that it's quite widely spread, which is a real worry.
Even though it's small amount of infestations, granted, you're thinking it's getting pretty close to Sydney, it's getting pretty close to things like the Ku-ring-gai National Park.
Oh, it's right on the doorstep. You can almost throw, if you had a good arm, you could throw a rock from Moonee Moonee into the Ku-ring-gai National Park. And all the beekeepers that are there in northern Sydney some of them may not be registered, and that would be a real concern. And then you have people that are trying to don't understand the importance of biosecurity, that are trying to protect their hives, might decide to take the risk and not tell DPI that they have hives. And then we're in real trouble.
They think the management of those people in the city, it's more a hobby. They're not really looking for varroa. They're not really watching their hives closely.
That's exactly it. And the lag time between infestation and actually realising that you have varroa mite there is a real concern. There might be a lot of people there that sort of think, oh, we don't have it. We're checking for it. We're doing all the right thing. And lo and behold, they'll have it months down the track. So, yeah, it's a real worry.
So it gets into the Sydney bee population, you know, and then I guess it gets into those local hives, and then it goes onto trucks, and then it starts moving around the countryside that way as well. And that's a potential concern too. And then that would mean, I guess, that we can't really control varroa mite in New South Wales.
Yeah, look, to be honest with you, Michael, I'm concerned that we won't be able to control it now, and I really do hope that I'm wrong with that statement, but it is a real worry. That period between the previous detection and these detections, quite a long period. So let's just hope that the DPI really are on top of it. And the thing that really worries me is that this is really closing the gate after the horse has bolted. One thing that hasn't been sort of brought up in this whole discussion is the funding of biosecurity. It's critical that biosecurity on our border gets funded properly. This should have been picked up before it got into our country. I mean, we should, if the funding was there properly, we would have been able to pick this up. A perfect example of this is something I heard this morning on the radio about the fact that the dogs that they use to sniff out bees haven't been trained since 2015, and they've only just started training them again. Now, why was that? That's small change with a massive consequence. And budget cuts and the lack of funding for biosecurity generally is a real concern. Like, this is over the top of the varroa mite. Could you imagine if we had a foot and mouth outbreak because the funding was too low? Now, that was right on our doorstep, and we prevented it coming in. But just imagine if we had foot and mouth in here. It would have been disastrous for this country. And funding needs to be right at the forefront of this discussion. There needs to be more funding for biosecurity.
We're also hearing from a whistleblower from AQUIS saying that they didn't think enough containers were being looked at. I think it's 1 in 100, this person was saying. So you think that needs to be ramped up?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. 1 in 100. That's a ridiculous amount of containers. And just think, if you had a dog that could sniff out bees and honey, how many more containers they'd be able to walk around all day and sniff around. That's what they love doing. It's just it's a extremely frustrating situation, and horticulturalists are paying the price for that now. Like we're dead scared as to what's going to happen this spring in our area. It's not just avocados; it's everything that has a flower.
My last point. I was going to come to you about pollination for crops. The almond industry saying that their production will be down this year. They won't be able to pollinate enough. Some broadacre crops won't be able to pollinate. The bees won't be moving around. That's the fear this year.
Oh, 100%. This is a real fear. And I mean, there's horticulture up and down the coast. Horticulture and avocado, a lot of avocado growers are on their knees. They've had some really bad weather conditions. We've had bad rain and prior to that drought, and there's a lot of growers, including myself, that are on our knees. We're really struggling, and this really is makes it even more serious, this lack of pollination.
Central Coast avocado grower Tim Kemp speaking there to David Claughton about more discoveries of varroa cases in his area. Coming up on the Country Hour, a niche crop in northern Tasmania, pine nuts, plus an explanation of how defleecing sheep works. And also we'll check the weather. First up, the news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. Leading campaigner for an Indigenous voice to Parliament, Professor Megan Davis, says today marks an historic day for the nation. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has released the proposed final wording of the referendum and on enshrining the voice in the Constitution. The state opposition has pressed the state government to explain how the number of Tasmanians experiencing homelessness increased by 44% between 2016 and 2021. New census data shows there were more than 2,300 people counted as homeless in 2021, compared with 1,600 in 2016. Two potential sites in Tasmania's south have been shortlisted to host a new youth justice facility. The state government has pledged to close the Ashley Youth Detention Centre near Deloraine by the end of next year and replace it with several therapeutic youth justice facilities. The sites are on Brighton Road between Pontville and Mangalore and off the East Derwent Highway overlooking the Bowen Bridge at Risdon. For Bulletin at 1.
Time now to check the latest on the weather. And Michael Conway joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Michael.
G'day, Tony.
Well, is it partly cloudy or mainly sunny? Which one?
I think it's... depends. If you look at it upside down, it's partly sunny.
mainly cloudy.
Sunny, yeah.
It's not too bad where I am anyway. Any rainfall about anyway?
Lovely weather. Yeah. There have been no rainfall reports in the gauges since 9 a.m. Yesterday, though, there were a few light falls about the east and the northeast. Pine Garner and Swan Island up in the northeast had 8 millimetres, and Edison, St Helens had 6 millimetres were the top readings about the state. But apart from that, it was pretty dry. It's looking like it will continue dry for most of the state, apart from perhaps a light shower this afternoon, but very light about the east. Tomorrow, though, there will be showers developing in the west in the morning. Again, pretty light on, 1 or 2 millimetres sort of thing, with a westerly flow starting as the ridge that's over the state moves slightly north. We're also expecting a weak trough over the northeast tomorrow, so there could be some showers up into the northeast and it's reaching as far west as perhaps Launceston, so there's a possible shower about there tomorrow.
Okay.
On the weekend,
Is it going to be windy tomorrow, windier?
Slightly. There'll be a little bit of an increase in a westerly or northwesterly wind tomorrow about the state, but again, it's only at moderate at the most. And then the ridge comes back down over Saturday and Sunday over the state, and it's pretty much just partly cloudy around the state with temperatures for all 4 days till then in the low 20s in most places.
Okay. I asked you this question yesterday. Are we any closer to any more rain? The old the old autumn break?
It's nothing too significant. There will be some light to moderate falls probably around Tuesday, Wednesday next week with a bit of an east to southeasterly flow. There will be a low most probably in the Tasman, and then that will direct some east to southeasterly flow over the state. So we could see some lightish showers. So no is the answer. Not too much.
So. I'd have to wait till April.
Yeah, maybe.
Warnings, are there any at this stage?
Zero today, and tomorrow we have a strong wind warning from the eastern and southern waters from Wineglass Bay around to Low Rocky Point.
And the coastal waters and swell, Mike, what's happening there?
Yeah, sure. Today the winds are generally in the southwest to southwesterlies, 10 to 20 knots. In the north, east to southeasterlies at 10 to 15. Turning southerly 15 to 20 knots in the northwest from the afternoon, and variable winds around 10 knots in the central north in the afternoon. There will also be sea breezes about in the north and east today. Tomorrow in the south and lower east to southeasterly winds 15 to 25 knots and reaching up to 30 knots from the afternoon. South to southwesterly winds 10 to 20 knots elsewhere, although variable to 10 knots about the northeast. So there will also be sea breezes in the north. The swells around in the west and south today and tomorrow, southwesterly at 2 to 3 metres. Tomorrow it'll be increasing to 3 to 4 metres in the afternoon. In the north, both days, a confused swell to 1 metre. In the east, south to southeasterlies today at 1 to 1.5 metres, turning southwest 1.5 to 2 metres offshore in the south. And tomorrow, southerly at 1 to 1.5 metres, turning southwest 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south.
And the wave rider buoys, where are they at?
Yeah, Cape Sorrel's at 2.3 metres and Maria Island at 1.5 at the moment.
Beauty. Thank you for that, Michael.
Thanks, Tony.
All the best, Mike. Michael Conway there from the Bureau with the latest information for you. Nothing much going to change for the next few days and possibility of some precipitation maybe next week. But we'll keep asking that question for you because I know there's a lot of farmers out there who are looking for that autumn break. Coming up, we'll take you to a pine nut farm in northern Tasmania in the Tamar Valley. And we'll also try and explain this defleecing of sheep where you'll just have to pull the wool off the sheep's back. Yeah, we'll explain that in just a few minutes' time.
This week on Landline, the toll of life on the water.
You're weak if you can't handle it. So, of course, that's the stigma that we're slowly changing.
And supporting early childhood learning in the bush.
We do things like messy play that mums are like, ah, no, you know, or we just be, you know, we just be.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
Coast to coast. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Also coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll talk about marron. Marron, the largest freshwater crayfish from WA. Until now, they've only produced on a small scale in farm dams, but we'll tell you about the plans for the future. You might be having some marron on your plate. If you make pesto at home, chances are the pine nuts come from Asia, which retail for around $80 a kilo in the supermarket. Well, farmer and agricultural scientist Andrew Bailey hopes his orchard at Winkley in the Tamar Valley can one day replace some of those imported nuts. Larissa Smith called into the farm to learn more about one of the world's most expensive nuts.
In the back of my mind, I just thought there must be something else that's possible to do with the land that if you're a small producer and not really in the game of cattle and sheep in vast numbers, there's something else you can do with your land and that you didn't need to get into grapes or massive stuff. And also that it suited the climate and the rainfall better than what we were currently using. And I'd heard about pine nuts years and years ago, and I thought, maybe that might be a viable thing.
Where are we standing?
The middle of Winkley. Yeah, I've had the place 25 years, and the pine trees have been in for about 12 years. And from an environmental point of view, or production point of view, it fits perfectly with where they would grow in Europe at the same latitude.
So these are a Mediterranean species of pine trees, not just your pine trees that you see around Tassie that are cut down for timber. They're totally different.
Totally different, yeah. They do have a timber aspect to them, but it's not considered brilliant sort of wood. You know, Pinus radiata definitely has that market stitched up. But in Europe, they are a native species that grow out in the country, and particularly, for example, during the war, when food was short, people would go out in the forest and collect pine cones and get the nuts out of those as a way of supplementing their diet because food was so scarce. And it's probably a bit like in Australia, we might wander out and collect mushrooms or bush tucker and that sort of stuff. In Europe, it fills a similar sort of role.
How old are these trees?
I've had the first lot in since 2015, and they have their 3 years worth of cones on them, because as I said, the cones take 3 years to mature, and so it's not a crop like a typical crop where you have an annual takeoff. You've got to be very patient, and but it's obvious which cones belong to which year, because they start from being a jelly bean sort of size, and then they'll go through to being something the size of a large grapefruit, so weigh possibly just under a kilo.
So realistically, how many years will it take for you to harvest your first pine nuts?
That's the challenging question, because there's only four of us in Australia that I know of that are doing this, and one of the producers in Victoria has probably been going 5 or 6 years longer than me, and he's definitely harvesting reasonable quantities. I'm looking to possibly harvest the first set of pines in maybe next year, maybe the year after. We still might be 5 or 6 years down the track before we've got enough where you've got a saleable quantity.
Can you find me a small cone on this tree, or okay, do we have to go hunting so I can see what it looks like?
If we look further into the tree, what chance I've actually seen
there's a couple there.
The previous year. Now you can see that's buried about 2 foot into the tree. And looking at that one, it's pliable. It hasn't gone black, because I've been talking to researchers in Chile, and they've given me some ideas on things to look for, just so you understand how the whole thing's progressing and whether that cone has died along the way or whether it's still viable and hopefully growing to its 3 year end. There's another one just here as well.
And that cone's about the size of a macadamia nut. So yes. not the full quid that you could associate with a pine tree.
Well, yes, but you can appreciate that it's got a lot of growing to do in the next, presumably this is from last year, so it's got a lot of growing to do in the next 2 years to get to that sort of 800 or 900 gram size.
And how tall can the trees get?
I believe they get to about 60 metres, but that's going to be well past my lifetime. They also grow to about 150 years. So if they become as productive as they are in Europe, then the cost of planting and everything else is well and truly paid for in the lifetime of the tree. The big challenge will be once we've got pine cones that are ready to harvest, getting the infrastructure to make that work efficiently. The cones normally, with warm weather, will open and sort of dehisce like other sort of plants do and pop that seed out. Now the challenge with these pine trees is that the seed comes out much like a pistachio seed, so it's already encased in a shell, and then we've got to further process that to get that seed out, and then you've got to polish it and it's fit for consumption.
How much are you hoping to make from these?
in terms of production, in terms of kilograms. That again's an unknown, because in the European context, they grow them differently. The first one is they tend to have them almost scattered, although they're moving to more of a plantation approach. The best examples we can look at are probably the Chilean experience and maybe the New Zealand one, but the Chileans are 50 years ahead of us, and so they've approached it very much from a production point of view, and they talk between 600, I think it is, and 1,500 kilograms of nuts per hectare. And then you go, there's only 4% nuts out of all that mass, so you're only talking hundreds, or at best 100 kilos maybe, or 200 kilos per hectare. But they are the most expensive nut in the world, for food nuts. So hopefully the economics is there, and we'll overcome all the challenges along the way.
Yes, a very patient Andrew Bailey speaking there to Larissa Smith about his pine trees in the Tamar Valley. There's around 400 pine nut trees he has, and looking to produce edible pine nuts in the next few years. Not sure whether it's next year or the year after, or maybe the year after that. As I say, very, very patient. Coming up, we'll talk about defleecing sheep.
Here we go.
David Astle.
Here is tonight's mashup. Oscar.
Is it Brave by Kate Sprunner?
Oh, that is superb. Can you help us out, Corey?
Snow Patrol with Chasing Cars.
All right.
Soul kind of feeling.
What connects tonight's three songs? This is the missing link puzzle.
That's the tricky bit, mate. Not me, sonny. Help me out, mate. James is 18.
David Astle.
A 10-year-old James would probably know.
Oh, they're all Disney films. Victor.
Monday to Thursday evenings from 7.
Corey and James is the best supporting actor.
On ABC Radio Hobart. It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And our text line number 0438 922 936. Well, you might have heard earlier this week about the wool industry's plan to speed up development of a thing called biological defleecing. It's a system where sheep are injected with a protein that puts a break in the wool fibre, making it possible to just pull the wool off by hand a week or two later. At a time when shearers are thin on the ground and some wool growers are paying more to shear than they're getting for wool, it's a welcome development. But when will it be ready? David Claughton spoke to lead researcher Professor Phil Hind from Adelaide University about the science behind the idea and the mysterious protein that comes out of a corn plant.
That was the breakthrough. We spent a lot of time trying to work out how it worked, and that's why it's taken such a long period of time. And we finally cracked it last year. The way it was working was through a mechanism operating in the wool follicle or hair follicle, which hardens the fibre. And it's quite a complicated process, but we are very confident now that this is the way to go for the wool industry. This system works, right? And that's what's been the breakthrough.
Because farmers will be worrying about, you know, what's the potential for this system, because previous systems haven't been particularly practical.
Yeah, no. And I'd have to say we're reticent to get overhype this, because we're well aware of the history of investment in this area of EGF and then BioClip and robots and so on. I wouldn't be saying that we're confident if I wasn't confident that this is a genuine possibility.
But you've got two major problems, though, haven't you? You've got to figure out how to get it into the sheep for the first instance. So what are you thinking there?
So that's what we're working on now. And we've got three target agents that are injectable. So it would be a simple subcutaneous injection, just like a vaccination, and that chemical only has to stay, and it's basically a naturally occurring amino acid, that only has to stay in the blood for a short period of time to create the weak point.
Right. So just a simple injection.
We envisage a single injection, turn the sheep back out for however long you like, anything after 2 weeks, 3 weeks, because that's enough to, the wool just regrows normally straight away as soon as the injection is cleared from the blood, which happens very quickly.
So have you been injecting in the field? Have you had any trials of that device?
Not yet. We're still doing it in animals in animal houses, because we've got to perfect it there you know, in terms of dose, time, the solution, you know, the formulation, and so on. So that's where we are with that.
Right, but that's working. And then the next thing is, I assume, how do you get the wool off the sheep?
Yeah, yeah. And that's the bit I'm less confident because I'm not an engineer.
Right.
But
that's a shame.
In mind.
I thought you were about to give me a solution there.
Well, we've already got one. We developed with AWI some time ago a handheld machine which peels the wool off like an orange peel after we've treated it and doesn't need any skill because there's no combs and cutters and stretching the sheep in the various ways that shearers have to do. No skin pieces, no cuts. But that's not the solution that we're looking towards in the long term. In the long term, we see a fully automated machine working its way across the animal because unlike robot shearing, it doesn't have to be close to the skin and it hasn't got any cutters. It's basically just breaking the weak point.
So can you describe what that is? I've heard air mentioned before. Is it something that blows the wool off? How does it work?
Yeah, so it's at the one we came up with is just mechanical. It's just a reciprocating plate which just goes into the wool and moves upwards away from the body and breaks it at high speed. And we envisage that can be incorporated into a device which runs across the animal with multiple mini units of that, using sensors to stay, you know, reasonably close to the sheepskin. It just comes across the animal. It's got multiple little units that are spinning at high speed and reciprocating at high speed, and they're just breaking wool, and then the vacuum sucks it off. Now, that's down the track. We're not there yet, and you know, no work has started on that fully automated engineering solution.
How far away is a commercially operating system, do you reckon?
So we're on a very tight schedule with AWI to deliver the injectable solution in 18 months.
Right.
The engineering solution is, I don't know.
And you have to round up your sheep twice? Like if you've got a big property and a few thousand sheep, like does that make it just too difficult if you've got to inject them first and then sort of get to the harvesting stage later?
Yeah, it does, but those properties may be able to keep sheep in confined feeding close to the shed.
So maybe you keep them confined for 4 or 5 days and then you could harvest after that?
Something like that. Maybe a bit longer. It depends on the environment. Cold environments need a bit more to protect from hypothermia. You know, I would think minimum of 1 to 2 weeks, I would think. This is an opportunity for the woolen industry to make a step change towards high throughput, rapid removal of wool and probably auto-classing of some sort, you know, with the wool coming off and going on a conveyor belt like the food industry uses.
Professor Phil Hines speaking there with David Claughton about biological defleecing, where sheep are injected with a protein that puts a break in the wool fibre. He says they're aiming to finalise the needle for injecting the protein and get it approved by the APVMA, the regulator, within 18 months. Is it looming an end for the shearer? We shall wait and see. Well, a Perth-based company has big plans for marin production in WA. Marin are the largest freshwater crayfish in WA, but until now they've only been produced on a small scale in farm dams. Aquatic AI is still only at the lab stage, but co-founders Andrew Walker and Michael Storey hope to use vertical farming practices and robotics to get the marin into restaurants throughout Australia and the world.
We think marin is iconic West Australian food. We'd like to have people all around the world, when they ask the question, well, what's Australian food? We want marin to come up in conversation as opposed to pies and Vegemite.
And for them to have actually eaten it as well because it's readily available.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're both from technology backgrounds and we're trying to develop a new scalable modular system for farming marin.
And how are you doing that? What does that look like?
Well, you will have seen some efforts to grow leafy greens in these great big vertical controlled farming environments around the world. We think something similar, if not the same, will work really well for aquaculture, especially for something like marin, where they don't necessarily play nicely with their neighbours in a pond. And so having some better controls around their environment can be of great benefit.
Where are you at in this process?
We're just coming towards the end of our two-year nutrition and feed underlying proof of concept funded by AgriFutures. And the data looks really good enough that we've started a fundraise basically to employ the engineering and data science work to fully build the first proof of concept end-to-end marin growing facility, which would still be not commercial scale, but prove all of the underlying unit economics of a commercial scale facility, at the end of which we would be ready to scale the production up.
So we had a lot of questions early on, like we have this approach, this vertical farming approach. Investors wanted to have some of the science risk removed. So that's what we've been working with the UWA, trying to prove that marin do grow in this system. And that's where we are.
And this vertical farming aspect that you're talking about, can you describe what that is?
Yeah, I think there's been probably 2 to 3 major kind of technological trends that have helped us design new ways of doing farming. The big constraints around marin farming in a traditional pond approach are very labor intensive, very water intensive, and land intensive. So the idea with going up is to address the land aspects. The labor intensive side, we really started with automation in mind. So we developed a system where, we wanted to go up. So the sorts of modular compartmental systems that you might imagine growing lettuce in, we started experimenting with systems like that. And if you can imagine, in order to make that happen, we need a lot of robotics because you can't go around to 1 million or 10 million or 20 million tanks every day as an individual to go and look at it. So it's going to need to have a lot of automation associated with it. And then once you've got robotics involved, and the advancements in robotics are really what is making that aspect possible. And the other part is the real advancements in the last couple of years in AI, and the ability to take data, understand what's going on, and make decisions that can then be given to a robot, which will enable the kind of ongoing management of such a system in a more optimal way than you could even do yourself. So when we're talking about doing it at scale, we've got lots of marin to look after, lots of automation required, huge amounts of data. If you can imagine, rather than one big system trying to manage thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of marin in a big pond, it's having millions of pet marin each being managed by a robot.
So why are you doing this?
Excellent question.
We saw the size of the WA rock lobster industry, and a lot of people prefer marin to WA rock lobster, and we were like, why is marin not bigger, not larger than it is? It's been 60 tons, the output's been 60 tons for the whole industry in WA for probably over a decade now, and we were being asked the question, why hasn't it got bigger? And we found a report by AgriFutures from 2017 about emerging industries, and it actually listed marin as a top candidate for growth potential. So I guess that's how we started.
So talking about scale, how big do you think you can scale up?
We think we can match the WA rock lobster industry. So that's, you know, $500 million industry and, what, 1,000 tons, give or take?
About 4,000 tons of export here. We've tried to develop a system that is modular, which would enable us essentially to prove that it works. And instead of then trying to make bigger tanks or bigger systems or anything, everything's about replication. And that really means the industry can be finally dictated by the supply, the limits on the supply of marin and pricing, etc., as opposed to how many can we produce. And we don't really think there's any limit on how many marin we could produce in this kind of a system. You could just keep on adding more tanks and adding more lines of production.
So you're confident there is a market out there and you wouldn't be flooding it by doing this?
If you dumped 2,000 tons of marin in Australia, I think you would definitely flood the market. But we also think there's a lot of countries out there that would really like it who just have no access to that.
And we wouldn't be, you know, overnight going to 1,000 tons. It's going to grow over years. So we are going to right size it to suit the industry, suit the demand.
That's Michael Story and Andrew Walker, co-founders of Aquatic AI. And they were speaking there to Sophie Johnston about their plans to produce WA Marin using vertical farming practices and also robotics. Now, if you go to our ABC Rural page, you'll see a fabulous story about Melissa Dunningham teaching people how to interact with horses. And she was named the Tasmanian Rural Women Award winner yesterday. And a great online story, the fabulous photo of Melissa and a couple of her horses. It's on the ABC Rural page.